Tonight we come to the conclusion of the first section of our study. Our purpose, our question is, who is Jesus? And in this first section, my aim has been very restricted aim, a very confined one, to try as best as I'm able, from the evidence of the New Testament, to see how Jesus' disciples looked at him while he was alive, while they were with him. And insofar as we were able, to see if we can discern how Jesus, his own aims and goals and self-understanding from the texts. Well, tonight we come to his death, so it's our last chance to glean from this material how they thought of him before he died. It's obviously a very beautiful kind of thing to try to deepen. And now we come to the last moments of his death. I want to start with you with John's account. Now, of course, it's obvious that John's account is written 40, 50 years later. So in that account, there'll be a lot of later reflections, won't there? There'll be a lot of further developments of John's thought as he himself lived through his life experience and so on. But what John's putting in the gospel, you see, they're not really additions. They're not extra thoughts. They're opening up, I would believe, of reflections on experience that John had at the foot of the cross. That's the key. You know yourself when something might have happened to you 30 or 40 years ago, but it's still significant to you now. Well, your way of speaking about it now will have a lot of insight that you didn't have at the time. But what you've got insight into is something that you perhaps half saw then, questions that didn't quite arise, but the experience of the time has constantly been throwing up further reflections. Do you take what I'm trying to say? So I want, if I can, with you, to go back to the foot of the cross tonight in this first section and to stand there with John and to go through his thoughts, to see what he saw, to half see the kind of things that stirred in him on that afternoon. John's material thoughts we find in the last part of his gospel. In fact, from chapter 13 to chapter 17, that's, what, five whole chapters, the Last Supper discourses, they're often called, are, in fact, John's reflections on the meaning of what he saw on Calvary. They're five whole and beautiful. I mean, you could go back and read them any time. And as you read those accounts, and I'll take you through a little bit of it tonight, what you're actually watching is the meaning of what you see on the cross. The first aspect that I think must come out, God takes us right back to our very first lecture, which was on Jesus' love. Well, John opens his long meditation on the meaning of Jesus in chapter 13, verse 1. This is the overall theme. The hour had come for Jesus to pass from this world to the Father. He'd always loved those who were in the world, and now he showed how perfect his love was. If you could imagine the afternoon, Jesus on the cross, imagine John standing there with his mother, then the overwhelming experience which is going to keep John going for years and years and years and give birth to the church was the extraordinary love that Jesus so obviously manifested there on the cross. The night before the supper, Jesus, it appears, gave meaning to what was going to happen the next day. He himself gave it meaning. And perhaps the power of it is that we saw last week looking at suffering. Yes, of course Jesus' crucifixion was a sin. Of course it was against God's will. Of course God wept when Jesus died, if I may use such terms for God, and of course I may. Of course it was a whole messy, terrible thing that happened to the beautiful and innocent Jesus, and it was done cynically, and it was done by political power, and don't let's lay all that on God, for heaven's sake. Jesus knew it wasn't God's design. But he also knew something else. He also knew that he had a mission from his Father to love. And he knew, and isn't this the agony in the garden, that he knew that if he kept loving and it led to his death, then somehow this death must come within the providence of God. Somehow God could find meaning in it and put meaning into it. Somehow, if Jesus could only take this inevitable consequence of the decisions that he made, if he didn't falter and back down and either lose faith in his Father or stop loving us, if he would maintain his mission, he knew that his God, his Abba, was not one that would lead him into a situation that would destroy the whole purpose of what he'd come to do. That even something as crazy, as counterproductive, as messy, as awful, as sinful, as despair-engendering as crucifixion, even something like that might save the world, might redeem the world. And on the night before he died, we're told, Jesus, seeing the inevitable thing coming, took that bread and that wine, that Passover meal, remembering the Paschal Lamb, remembering the journey into freedom, remembering the promise of Yahweh to take his people out of slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land, and knowing the terrible slaveries that were around him, even in that room. He could see Judas fidgeting and nervous and anxious and all that going on. He could see Peter he could see the looks on his friends, and of course it's often easier to suffer something yourself than to see others you love suffer, isn't it? He could see the kind of mess of that, and what was he to do with it? So he took it. He gave it meaning. He did it freely. He held his life and said on an earlier occasion, and here he's saying it again at the supper, "No one takes my life from me." Oh, they can kill him. Sure, but that's not taking his life from him. The life spirit was what he breathed to his Father freely. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own free will. This is the command, the trust, the mandate that I have been given by my Father, and he loves me. John chapter 10. And on that night, he took this bread, this broken bread, which symbolized the haste and of a journey, Israelite journey out of Egypt, and he broke it again. And when he broke it, his own kind of heart broke, and his body broke, and his person broke, as it were. And he offered it, this broken bread, to nourish them. And he said, "This is my life I'm giving you to nourish you on your journey. I give it to you." And when he poured the wine out of the carafe into the jug, whatever, and handed it around, the pouring of the wine, you can tell the colour of it, can't you? The art pouring, the blood colour. He gave it a meaning, and he said, "Take this cup now. It's my blood poured out, my life poured out, my life given, laid down for you, made holy, sacrificed for you." And as John then, with his mother, with us tonight here, stand there watching him die, I think, anyhow, in heavens it's so deep to try to say, but I think the strongest impression was of love-giving. John says it. It was of freedom. Jesus is not the victim. He's not succumbing to anything. He can't avoid it except by stopping loving. He will not stop loving. And so he takes into his heart into his person, the consequences of love, makes it his own and offers even this, not my will but thine be done thing, offers it to them and offers it to the Father in total trust of the presence and the saving, redeeming presence of the God he knew was love. In his letter, many years later, John had this to say about love. And no doubt the cross was the most powerful statement of it. He said, "My dear people, this is not a new commandment that I'm writing to tell you. It's an old commandment that you were given from the beginning. The original commandment which was the message brought to you. Yet," he said, "in another way, what I'm writing to you and what is being carried out in your lives, as it was in his, is a new commandment." Why? Because the night is over and the real light is already shining. Perhaps if you were the thief on the cross, you'd know what that text was saying. Our world keeps seeing it. We keep seeing beautiful people brought down. We keep seeing great ideals dragged into the mud. We keep seeing innocent people oppressed. We keep seeing the humble of the land, you know, driven. And when we're watching the cross, we might look as though we're seeing something like that again. But what the cross did for John, it appears, and for all of us, and like, isn't this why we say it saves or redeems the world, is that what John saw there, and the other evangelists as well, as we'll see later, was they just couldn't stop him loving. They couldn't take his life. They couldn't. That's what it's possible for human nature to be. That's what's possible for a man to be. Nothing, he said himself, can separate us from the love of God. Paul will pick up the theme later. And how would we know that? The old commandment of love was always there. Adam knew it and Eve knew it. We all know it. Everyone wants it. Who doesn't want to love? We're all on about it. We're all searching for ways of being it and giving it and being in it. It's totally common humanity. But how do you do it against all the kind of pressures we looked at last week? John, when he watched Jesus on the cross, saw someone doing it. And that's what made it new. The old command was there. Now it's a... What's new about it now is that it's happened. Someone's done it. The night is over. We now know that it's possible to be a human, to be a human being, and to love the way Jesus loved. And so now when he says to us, "Love one another as I have loved you," we're going right to the extreme, aren't we? But even death, the kind of death Jesus suffered, the terror of it and the stupidity of it and the meaninglessness of it, even in his innocence, even all that cannot stop you loving. So nothing can stop you loving. No one can ever threaten you again, or me, or anybody. We've been released from the fear, ultimately, of death. As we watch Jesus on the cross, we don't only see his love. And here we go back again to an earlier lecture, but they seem to see it now, at least the beginnings of it John saw, and later it'll mature, but something happened there that convinced him of God. "My Father," said Jesus earlier in John 8:29, "my Father doesn't leave me to myself, for I always do what pleases him." When John looked at the cross, he saw Jesus loving, but he also saw why. Jesus told him why. He's very clear on it. It was because Jesus believed in his Father. That is what sustained him. His total trust in the one, the God he called Abba. That's what sustained Jesus. We've got to give Jesus the, at least do this much, believe him. We've got to believe him when he says, this is why I'm able to do it. This is what's sustaining me. It was, as Hebrews says, 12:2, for the sake of the joy which was still in the future, he endured the cross, disregarding the shamefulness of it. He placed his trust in the life giver, and he knew that even if he was killed, no one could take the breath of God from him. And that was what sustained him. That's what gave him his peace. That's what gave him his joy on the cross. That's what gave him, he said, the ability to radiate the mystery of God. And so it gives us a total new idea of God. We could blame God for Jesus on the cross, and some very distorted theologies do exactly that. Not Jesus and not Christianity. We don't glory in suffering as Christians. What we glory in is the presence in suffering of a lover whom we call God. Some meditations from the Last Supper that might help you as you look at Jesus on the cross. Do not let your hearts be troubled, said Jesus. Trust in God still and trust in me. Do not let your hearts be troubled as you watch the crucifixion. Trust in God still and trust in me. And again, from the cross, John meditating on the meaning of it as Jesus helped him glimpse it on that night before he died and through the Passion. Peace I bequeath to you. My own peace I give you. A peace the world cannot give. This is my gift to you. Do not let your heart be troubled or afraid. And as John stood there with Mary's mother, you are sad now, Jesus is saying to Mary, to John, to you, but I shall see you again, and your heart will be full of joy, and that joy no one shall take from you. Be brave. I have conquered the world.